Everything as long as it's free. I want your love. Love, love, love. I want your love. I want your drama, the touch of your hand. Welcome, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. As ever and always, I am joined by Anya Esther in the production booth, my partner in crime, my sometimes guest host. Welcome back. This past Monday, I spent a little bit of time talking about Mitt Romney and his new book, A Reckoning, and I couldn't let that observational moment go without one of my favorite Romneyisms. It hangs in the memory because it's just one of those moments where you would think perhaps someone has talked to him about how to talk about this. And we're just going to let the words speak for themselves. Here's Mitt Romney when he was running for president.
Pay equity for women.
Thank you. And important topic. And one which I learned a great deal about, particularly as I was serving as governor of my state, because I had the chance to pull together a cabinet, and all the applicants seemed to be men. And I went to my staff and I said, how come all the people for these jobs are all men? They said, well, these are the people that have the qualifications. And I said, well, gosh, can't we find some women that are also qualified? And so we took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women. I was proud of the fact that after I
binders full of women. Let's just recap what happened in this. What is it, like less than a minute's worth of speech, Anya?
It's only 57 seconds, and like 10 of that was her asking the question. Yeah.
Lordy. Okay. It's an important pay equity, an important topic. It's a topic. Yeah. For some of us, it's economic reality. It's not a topic. And I had an opportunity to learn a lot about it. Again, as if it's this thing. And they told me these were the qualified people that applied. One might want to pause when you see that you only have like white dudes applying for jobs. What sort of environment have I created where these are the only people that apply? So I went out and got myself binders full of women. Well, what did you do with them? Did you hire any?
He's got them. That was his job.
Put those ladies up on that shelf because I've got the binders now. Mitt. Anyways, I couldn't, on the one hand, give former senator, former GOP presidential candidate Romney a wee bit of credit for acknowledging that Trump is a menace without talking about the old binders full of women. We ran out of time on Monday, so why not resurrect it on this cold Wednesday afternoon? All right, if you want to join us, 844-967-2789. The next thing that this is an observation, and if you want to comment on this, I welcome you to call. The bulk of our show today, I'm going to be spending talking about the 8th and 11th Circuit decisions that are combining in a 1-2 punch to basically render the Voting Rights Amendment a nullity. It may very well have no effect. And I'll explain that. You're not going to want to miss it, because what we all should want in a democracy is that the franchise of citizens is protected and respected, as well as election processes. These are one and the same issues. If you want to talk about election integrity, you also want to talk about protecting voting rights. So you're not going to want to miss that. But before we get there, something today came out in the news, and I just thought this bears not just observing, but I wanted to try to explain why it matters so much. And it's this. Representative Comer has been going on about Hunter Biden for quite some time. I have repeatedly said on this show and on any other show, place, bar stool where I am asked, if Hunter Biden or Joe Biden have committed a crime and there is evidence to prove such, they should be charged. Period. And their crimes should be heard either by a jury or they should plead out to them. And there's been a lot of, oh, well, these couple of people that aren't really credible said this, that, and the other, but there's no direct evidence. There's a lot of insinuations. Oh, there's these checkbook accounts, and where's the documents? And they subpoenaed Hunter Biden and his lawyer responded and said, hey, we'll show up. And he will testify under oath before a congressional committee headed by Mr. Comer. But he wants to do it in a public hearing. And Mr. Comer, the ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, excuse me, not the the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, said, nope, we don't want you testifying in public. We're going to do it in a private, closed-door hearing. This is bad. It's really bad. The reason that they use closed-door hearings is for, there's a whole gamut of reasons. Most of them relate to the fact that the subject matter may be national security sensitive. There's threat to witnesses. You have to protect the identity, the materials, those sorts of things. You don't just do willy-nilly private hearings because, yeah. And here's the reality. Private hearings, where all you have is a transcript, allow folks to paint different snippets of testimony in different ways. In other words, it permits more spin. And so you want to subpoena Hunter Biden, you want him to come swear an oath. If he lies, face criminal perjury charges. He's saying he'll show up, but he wants it to be in public. And Representative Comer says, no, I'm not going to do it in public. The only way I'll do this is in a private hearing. Now, that is bunk. And everyone who has been screaming about Joe and Hunter Biden should tell Representative Comer and every other GOP member, if he's going to come and he's going to swear an oath and he's going to do it in a live public hearing, let him. Because here's what I know as a lawyer. And this is going to come up when I'm talking about a couple of these Voting Rights Act decisions. What a lawyer and a judge will tell you, we actually have principles of judicial review that credit the way that trial courts and fact finders assess witness credibility because they're closest to the witness testimony, is that transcripts can only tell you so much. Live videotaped testimony tells you so much more. It provides every person the ability to assess someone's credibility, their truthfulness, their responsiveness to questions. Yes, there would be a circus-like atmosphere. Yes, the questions would be like, when did you stop beating your wife? They would bake in the conclusion. But Mr. Biden would be given an opportunity to answer them. And when you do it in public, the American public would have an opportunity to assess Hunter Biden's credibility. And if you want to test someone's credibility, if you want to show them a liar, an obfuscator, a BS artist, you do it with the cameras rolling. And he said he'll show up and he wants to do it in public and you're saying no, that means you don't have the goods. It's as simple as that. He's calling your bluff. Take him up on it. as I've said all along, if I'm Joe Biden, if I'm Hunter Biden, I'm going to bring on the hearings. They'll be a circus, but let's go do the thing. Because I've got nothing to hide, unlike all the people from the other side of the aisle, from that previous administration that have dodged valid congressional subpoenas and don't show up and won't testify under oath. I don't get it. I don't understand how that's defensible. Here's what Representative Jamie Raskin said about this. Let me get this straight. After wailing and moaning for 10 months about Hunter Biden and alluding to some vast, unproven family conspiracy, after sending Hunter Biden a subpoena to appear and testify, Chairman Comer and the oversight Republicans now reject his offer to appear before the full committee and the eyes of the world to answer any questions that they want to pose? Here's the punchline. What an epic humiliation for our colleagues, and what a frank confession that they are simply not interested in the facts and have no confidence in their own case or the ability of their own members to pursue it. Yep. The Maryland Democrat concluded what Republicans fear most is sunlight and the truth. Let the American public, let the world judge Mr. Hunter Biden's credibility. Let us see him swear an oath and be asked questions from all comers, including you, Mr. Comer. All right. The other little bit that happened, and I don't know if we'll have enough time before I have to go to some very important messages from our sponsors, is that Kevin McCarthy gave a little speech, a little fundraising speech in a fancy tuxedo this past Sunday. And he laid down a whopper. I mean, say what? And he was so proud of just a complete and utter load of garbage. And he was so proud of it because he got applause from his friendly audience that he then went and posted it on X. And took some heat. We've got the sound of what Kevin McCarthy said this past Sunday in his penguin outfit. You're not going to want to miss that. And then I'm going to turn to the Voting Rights Act and why it may not exist after the Trump-appointed judges have their way with it. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Come on, join us this afternoon. There's so much going on. We'll talk about anything you want. 844-967-2789. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn, joined by Anastasia Esther here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Go ahead and go get the app. It makes life so much easier. It's free. Act like it's, you know, not free and send it in some sort of e-card to all of the folks that are on your holiday gift lists. They give you the gift of searing insight. Well, apparently Kevin McCarthy, former Speaker of the House, does need some searing insight about actual U.S. history, because this past weekend, this is what he had to say.
Peace without freedom is meaningless. Think for one moment. It is human nature that we all crave peace, but we never attain it unless we have freedom. In every single war that America has fought, we have never asked for land afterwards, except for enough to bury the Americans who gave the ultimate sacrifice for that freedom we went in for.
Okay.
But the basis of their definition is wrong.
What? First of all, what's the random bell thing? Was someone summoning the butler? Like, Jeeves, more cocktails, please. I don't. It's just so weird. Here's the line. I mean, we could talk for a whole hour about there's no peace without freedom. No. That exists all the time. Authoritarians do it by really scary, but it does often create peace for some people. That's just factually not true. It's the quality of the peace that you may be talking about. But I've now gotten into a bit of a philosophical discussion. The nut of what I want to talk about that's so ridiculous is this line. In every single war that America has fought, we have never asked for land afterwards. Shall we begin the beginning?
I think we
should. Let's do tell. The American Revolutionary War. I do think we took some land. In fact, we took a whole lot of land from Britain. It basically created the United States. That was all land. How about that land that Britain claimed possession of, which we then took from Britain, that actually used to be that of First Nation peoples, of indigenous peoples, and the genocide that we perpetrated to reach our manifest destiny, if you will. Yep, we're taking land from some people. Some bloody battles fought over that. That's taking land. We put them on things called reservations and said, just here, until we decided we wanted that too, and then moved them somewhere. There's a thing called the Trail of Tears. I think, we've taken some land. Guam, Puerto Rico, the Philippines. We took that land after the Spanish-American War of 1898. In 1899, we took American Samoa after the Second Samoan Civil War. And was there a Mexican American War? Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure that the Mexican American War resulted in over 500,000 square miles being added to the United States, including Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Wyoming, and that other enormous state that McCarthy represents a portion of, that would be California. Yes, that was the Mexican-American War, which ended in 1848. Apparently, Senator McCarthy has indeed forgotten the Alamo. And I think George Conway perhaps put it best. Think of all the wisdom from Kevin McCarthy we'd be deprived of if his home state of California had never spontaneously risen from the sea and attached itself to the United States. I mean, what? And people applaud this. Anyways, you can't make it up. The stuff just flies out of their mouths. Thanks for folks commenting on Facebook and Instagram. Yeah, we don't ask, we take. Yes, we fight wars over it, then we take some more. Former Speaker of the House, you got that guy, then Mike Johnson, let's return to these 18th century values. I'm sure that's been working out well for the women and people of color from that era. It was neither progressive nor an era. Discuss. But now I've lapsed into old Mike Myers routines from Saturday Night Live of yore. Okay, join our show, 844-967-2789. Let me get started, because these Voting Rights Act cases are simply beyond the pale. And it's been moving this way for quite some time, basically since 1982. But let's set our historical basis. Oh, yeah. Anya's reminding me, of course, we took Hawaii too. Yeah, yes.
Just a whole country that we nabbed for fun.
Yeah, that's ours now.
Yeah. But we didn't ask, so.
Yeah. Just take. All right. The Voting Rights Act, if you're not familiar or don't recall, was passed in 1965. It was precisely passed because the promises of the 15th Amendment enacted after the Civil War to ensure the franchise, the voting rights of former enslaved people, of Black folks in this country, was not being observed in the South. Jim Crow era laws had a long reach, a long, long reach. And the 15th Amendment basically says you cannot deny the right to vote based on race or a previous condition of enslavement. Okay? And that just wasn't happening. And the first big question that came about from a what does the 15th Amendment and therefore the Voting Rights Act mean was, okay, if there seems to be a Voting Rights Act violation, in other words, people are having their voting rights impaired based on race, do you have to show that that discrimination is intentional, or can you simply show that the effect of a law or a process, etc., had the effect of having a racially discriminatory impact? Okay, so do you have to show intentionality, or do you just have to show that it is, in fact, when it's put into practice, racially discriminatory? In 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you have to show intentionality, which is an extraordinarily high bar. When we come back, I'll tell you what a bipartisan Congress did in response to that. I'm Maggie Dawn. She is Anastasia Esther. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us, 844-967-2789. Keep it locked, because I'm going to tell you how the VRA is getting rolled on back. Welcome back, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join our conversation this afternoon. Talk or text 844-967-2789. We had a texter ask about our acquisition of Alaska. We purchased it for $7.2 million in 1868. The detail on Hawaii is basically you had Native Hawaiians and non-Native American businessmen that were in a battle of sorts over the control of Hawaii. And the United States stepped in and on July 7, 1898, annexed it. Again, take. Okay. Returning to the Voting Rights Act, and for those of you who are on the lines, I will get there. Please hang out with me, because these cases are absolutely incredible, and not in the good way. So, Supreme Court in 1980 said, in order to bring a claim under the Voting Rights Act, you have to prove basically that the law that you are challenging intentionally discriminates against people based on race. Extremely hard, because people aren't stupid enough even back then to say, hey, let's actually write a law and talk about it, because it's going to keep Black people from voting. More on that in a moment, because that one's coming back. And guess what happened in response to that? Because it made the bar to bring a Voting Rights Act claim so high. Congress, bipartisan Congress in 1982, changed the law. They amended the Voting Rights Act, and they said, you don't have to prove intentionality. You don't have to prove intent. You can just show that it has a racially discriminatory, the law that you're challenging has a racially discriminatory effect. Ta-da! 1982. Apparently then, bipartisan. Yes, bad if we're discriminating against Black people and trying to keep them from voting. That's not a good thing. But even back then, there was a very unknown lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department that thought this was terrible and a no good, very bad thing. His name was none other than John Roberts, now Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Roberts. He wrote scores of legal memorandum that basically said that any kind of remedy, any kind of law that attempted to remediate or address the impacts of slavery, of Jim Crow, of lynchings, of all of these systemic and legally sanctioned things that deprived Black folks of the full rights of American citizenship, anything like that was repugnant to the Constitution because it took race into consideration. Does this sound familiar at all? Because this was the affirmative action decision of a few months ago. But John Roberts was hatching this about the Voting Rights Act long ago. Now, the difference between affirmative action is you're talking about affirmative action and voting rights. I'm not going to get into the differences. Suffice it to say that when it comes to the franchise to vote, there has been a higher tolerance within the federal courts for allowing race to be discussed explicitly because of Jim Crow. Makes sense. Oh, no, you have to pass the citizen test. Well, Kevin McCarthy would fail that, wouldn't he? You got to own this land. You got to speak the English. That's illegal. If you're a citizen, you get to vote. That's what the Constitution says. There are no other requirements. And by the way, it's the most stupid, naive, reality-defying perspective in the world that only a rich, Ivy League-educated white man would ever say that, listen, we deal with the impacts of racial discrimination by not ever talking about race. And so now, 2013, John Roberts wrote a decision about the Voting Rights Act. And they struck down what were called the pre-clearance requirements of the Voting Rights Act, which basically said for states that had a history of explicitly, without using the words, let's keep Black people from voting, but basically extraordinarily explicit laws that prevented Black people from voting, I had to go to the U.S. Department of Justice and say, hey, can we pass this law? Can we run our elections this way? It was the pre-clearance requirement. John Roberts, 2013, and the Shelby decision, wiped that off the books. Bye-bye. So, and by the way, this is the little nugget from the Shelby decision that I still find so disturbingly grotesque in its construction. Here it is. The blight of racial discrimination in voting that has infected the electoral process of our country for nearly a century is no longer present. So John Roberts got out his magic wand in 2013 and went, racism over, ta-da, nothing to worry about. Proceed on. Nothing to see here, says a white guy in a robe on the Supreme Court. Here's what Justice Ginsburg said, because she dissented, and I too dissent. Throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes in voting laws is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. Yep, RBG dropping some knowledge bombs. So what happened after that? Discriminatory voter ID laws, purges of voter rolls that were targeted at Black people, young people, disabled people, elderly people. racial gerrymanders, and ridiculous early voting limits and rules. By the way, we talked about yesterday, why the heck don't we vote on Saturdays? Nobody knows. Oh, wait, makes it really hard for working people to vote. Who tends to work more? You know, folks that maybe are in a group that hasn't enjoyed the full panoply of American citizenship rights for the entirety of our nation's history. Maybe those people might be working a little bit more than John Roberts. I bet John Roberts goes and votes on a Tuesday, maybe over his lunch hour, because he gets a lunch hour. He can saunter over to a voting booth from the Supreme Court. And by the way, of course, the Supreme Court upheld gerrymanders by saying, oh, well, that's not racial. It's political gerrymandering, and that's just fine. But that's just not saying the quiet part out loud. And oh, by the way, see earlier podcasted versions available on civicmedia.us, where I cite the enormous number of Republicans who have said in the last 5 to 15 years that, yeah, the voter ID laws, the gerrymandering, the voter roll purges, and the early voting limits and rules. Yeah, that's exactly, they say it out loud, quote, quote, quote. Yeah, that's about keeping black people from voting. You just say it. So they're back to saying it out loud. Now, impressively, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 recent decision, upheld Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Okay, this was a case out of Alabama. And it wasn't the Supreme Court, it was an appeals court. And they have forced these maps back to Alabama twice now and have ordered Alabama to redraw maps. And the Supreme Court has declined to review it. So some light here. Oh, good thing. Maybe John Roberts actually thinks the Voting Rights Act has some purpose. But here's what has just happened. 7 days ago, the Eighth Circuit, in a 2-1 decision, said that the Voting Rights Act cannot be the basis for a private citizen to bring a lawsuit or a voter group to bring a lawsuit, that there is no private right of action, that the only party that can sue under the VRA is the government. That has not been the case ever. Ever. When you do that, you basically will wipe out about 75% of the cases, if not more, that end up in Voting Rights Act decisions that protect the franchise of black and brown folks, disabled folks, Latino and Latine folks. You just wipe them off, but they don't exist anymore. And by the way, if you have a U.S. Department of Justice that's, I don't know, run by a great orange man who thinks it should be weaponized to punish his enemies and who has no interest in protecting the voting franchise of black and brown folks, do you think the DOJ is actually going to go about enforcing the Voting Rights Act? No. And here's what's so absolutely incredible about this decision. The court acknowledges that Congress, this is a quote, quote, Congress had clearly intended all along to allow private enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. And decades of Supreme Court precedent support that interpretation. Unbelievable. Well, we'll just throw out congressional intent and all of our precedent, and the Eighth Circuit goes, you all had it wrong. Never mind, no private right of action. And by the way, in 1982, when Congress amended the Voting Rights Act, it says in the congressional record, in the House report, this, quote, "It is intended that citizens have a private cause of action to enforce their rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act." How about this? My math on the radio was wrong. Of the 182 successful Voting Rights Act lawsuits over the past 40 years, only 15 of them were brought by the Attorney General of the United States. What? Even a Trump-appointed judge on this Eighth Circuit was totally apoplectic about this and dissented. He was the one dissenter. He wrote this: until a court rules or Congress amends the statute, I would follow existing precedent that permits citizens to seek a judicial remedy. Rights so foundational to self-government and citizenship should not depend solely on the discretion or availability of the government's agents for protection. Hear, hear, sir, I say. This is extraordinary. It effectively guts the Voting Rights Act. If you are on the line, stay there. When we come back, I'm going to tell you the 1-2 punch that we've got here. Just this past Friday. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to this cold Wednesday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show, explaining to us why we really should probably be paying attention to what's happening in the federal courts about the Voting Rights Act. Keep it locked. You're not going to want to miss us after this last segment. Join us, 844-967-2789, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. They always want to come, but they never want to leave.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans.
Bobby, welcome back, everybody. So damn, just before it rained. Never tell you, Anya. I used to drink Southern Comfort in college as if my name was Janis Joplin.
You've told me that once or twice when I've ordered it. Yeah.
Yes. Just trying to resurrect a little Janice. But don't worry, I won't sing on the radio. Okay, returning to the Voting Rights Act, I just want to share this little tidbit. Justice Gorsuch and Thomas put the breadcrumbs down in 2021 for someone to challenge the Voting Rights Act on the basis that there is no private right of action, or effectively to defend a lawsuit brought by a citizen trying to ensure that their voting rights aren't stripped from them. And they left this little tidbit in a little dissent. This was in the Brnovich v. DNC. By the way, not a dissent, a concurring opinion. And they basically wrote, it was like a one-page concurring opinion. They wrote to make this very point. This is Gorsuch and Thomas in 2021. I join the court's opinion in full, but flag one thing it does not decide. Our cases have assumed without deciding that the VRA of 1965 furnishes an implied cause of action under Section 2. Because no party argues that the plaintiffs lack a cause of action here, this court need not and does not address that issue today. That is techno lawyer speak for, hey, next time, bring up the fact that there's no private right of action, and we will let these oppressive and discriminatory laws stand. And indeed, that is what happened. And here's the interesting factoid about that. The case that they cited to stand for that principle was a lower court, an appeals court ruling from 1981. Well, remember what I told you about 1982? That's when Congress changed the law and said explicitly in the congressional record that indeed private citizens have a private right of action. Seems to me like Justices Gorsuch and Thomas need to do a little bit better on their recollections of the historical record that they love to rely on so very, very much. All right. So you've got the idea. There's no private right of action. All those 182 cases over 40 years, only 15 ever brought by the Department of Justice. You add to that the fact that if you got a guy like DJT in charge of the Justice Department, there's going to be zero claims, zero cases brought based upon any of this. Right? That's scary enough. You couple that with the striking down in 2013 in the Shelby case of the preclearance requirement. In other words, states don't have to go ask, hey, is this going to be racially discriminatory anymore? And then you add this one, the 11th Circuit on Friday. And I'm not going to get into the detail here because this is one of the worst written decisions I have ever read. It simply does not make any sense. And I can usually make at least some sense of what they're trying to say. I can't hear. Here's what the 11th Circuit held on Friday. Federal law does not permit a federal court to order the legislature of a state to change the method of election for certain statewide offices because the state's chosen form of government is afforded protection by federalism and our precedents. I'm going to say that again because everybody should be going, wait, what, blit. Federal law does not permit federal courts to order state legislatures to change the method of election for statewide offices because the state's chosen form of government is afforded protection by federalism and our precedents. Let me translate for y'all. We don't like the Voting Rights Act, and we think states should be able to racially discriminate. Ta-da! The Voting Rights Act, according to the 11th Circuit, doesn't exist anymore. That happened on Friday. What if not the protection of voting rights does a democracy stand for? And I'd argue not very much. Annie from Watertown, what do you have to say this afternoon?
Oh, Jesus, 27 things. How deep we are, and how are we ever going to get out of the backwardsness of we've gone backwards so far in the last few years. But I guess I really, the main thing I'd like to get you on is this whole thing of intent. I mean, it seems to apply more often when there's a wealthy security, money securities violation or something, where, you have an act car accident, do they ever go deep enough to say, did you intend to do that? Did you intend to, speed, but did you intend to kill that person? I mean, intent doesn't really come in on the minor things. It seems to be very important, though, on things that will protect somebody that has enough money to, say, hey, I didn't intend to do that. I mean, do you find that to be applying?
And yeah, Annie, it's a great point. All of a sudden the bar is intent when it's really wealthy people and the enfranchised and the powerful. All of a sudden, let's make it harder for the poorer people and the disenfranchised to bring causes of action. Mark from the SAC, what do you have to say this afternoon?
Yeah, well, considering that the Constitution guarantees a Republican form of government in all the states, that last thing where they said all states can decide how they run elections is kind of ridiculous. But again, I go to, the tired old saw, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, as amended with the subsequent amendments, expanding the franchise to people, including people of the age of 18, reaching the age of 18, guarantees individual right to vote. And if the Constitution itself guarantees an individual right to vote, then individuals should have a cause of action against the government that is infringing, abridging.
I got to cut you off, Mark. 100%. The 11th Circuit is wrong because federalism defers to state governments, except if you are racially discriminating, you idiots. Jim, you got 20 seconds. I'm going to give it to you. JD, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I've read and reread the Constitution, and I can't find anywhere in it that the Supreme Court has the authority to blatantly remove laws duly passed by Congress.
Amen, brother. That's all we got time for. Thanks so much for listening. Let's rein those Supreme Court justices in. You're not going to want to miss